VOCM presents Nightline. The opinions expressed on this show are not necessarily those of this station. And now your host, Jonathan Richler.
There it is. We are a little late out of the gate. I'm in the middle of a wonderful conversation. Sorry, Patrick. Come on, ye good people. I'll sing you a song about the poor people, how they get along. Good evening to everybody out there in Radioland. It is Daryl Power in the chair, sitting in for Jonathan Richler, who is at the Seafood Fest out in Bay Roberts tonight, sending pictures of absolutely beautiful, beautiful dishes here on Twitter tonight, if you wanted to follow him at Jonathan Richler. Tonight, we're going to do things, start off a little bit differently. The LGBTQ community is growing and thriving in the province, and times are changing. But many say they aren't changing fast enough. You might remember the story from earlier in the week, last week, where Marley Bowen, originally from Newfoundland, who now lives in Toronto, and she came to Newfoundland as a member of Get Real to educate kids on student rights. And only 13 students were actually there to participate in that talk. Most of the parents kept their kids home. One caller during this crazy week that I've spent suggested that maybe it's up to parents to educate their own kids about equal rights and sexuality. So I had a great idea that maybe it's also time to educate the parents. So it's time we actually take a walk a mile in someone else's shoes and see things through her lens. I have one guest in the studio tonight, but we're going to talk about the lives. Two separate lives, really. We're going to talk about the life of the child, Dean Harnham, and the life of the adult, Dean Harnham, and the new life of Sarah Harnham, who emerged 1 month ago. Sarah, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I don't know where to start because there's so much to say. Why don't we just go right back to the beginning? Tell me about the six-year-old Dean Harnham.
Six-year-old Dean Harnham. The earliest remembrance I have of being different. I wanted to play with my sister and her friends. But boys didn't play with dishes back then. They weren't allowed.
And which community was this? Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in a little town called New Harbor out in Trinity Bay. Very, very rural at the time. Less so now because we're more interconnected. But very traditional, very gendered, very clear distinctions between male and female and what their roles were. So my nan told me to go play with the boys, my brothers. But I wasn't like them. And I wasn't like my sister. But I was more like my sister than my brothers. So I learned how to play alone a lot. And growing up, you fit into the mold, the one that's given to you. Boys do this, boys do that. Boys play with this toy, boys play with that toy. And I learned my roles very well and fought being her tooth and nail. And did, all the things, checked off all the boy boxes. Joined the Boy Scouts, cadets, although it was co-ed at the time, thankfully. Went off, got married, joined the Canadian Forces Reserves as a cadet officer. Doing all the things that males do.
But even at six years old, you realized that you were trapped in a boy's body.
I didn't have the terminology at six. I mean, it was 1973 in rural Newfoundland. There was nothing even close to being called sex ed, even in high schools. And I just knew I was different, that I didn't fit. I didn't fit as a boy, and I didn't fit as a girl. Because even though my brain told me I was a girl, when I looked in the mirror, I saw a boy's body. Right? So the world saw a boy. So I built Dean. I made Dean. And I made Dean what the world can interact with. But in doing that, I built a little box for Sarah. A little box with a small window and no door. And that's where she stayed until just a couple of years ago.
I guess that part of it, it must have been so difficult for you because it's almost ingrained in you to feel ashamed for, you know, like as a shame and embarrassment as opposed to doing or, you know, being who you really want to be.
Mm-hmm. Well, society told you that if you were male-bodied or assigned male at birth, as the term goes, if you were feminine or effeminate, you were less. You were less of less worth, of less value. You were an other. So I didn't do that. I was very much a man's man. You know, in the cadet program, I taught marksmanship and small arm safety. I taught bushcraft. You know, all the traditional male roles, which are total BS, to be honest. Because as I trained these cadets to shoot originally 22s and later on air rifles, some of the best shots I taught were girls. They were by far better shots than boys, which made me very proud on a very deep level. But yeah, shame, society teaches us that you had to fit a mold. Well, society is wrong.
It's funny then that you would be drawn to a life in the reserves, which is pretty well, you know, a macho male behavior and misogyny right at its, you know.
It can be, yes.
So I would not expect you to have landed and to have a career in that environment.
I played my role very well. I built Dean very meticulously. I built him with as much depth as I could. And anybody who's known me for the past 50 years, and they've told me, we had no idea.
So were you... You were considered and were successfully able to establish yourself as one of the boys.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
When I first met you, it was at an NL Poly function at Ben's, which everyone should attend one in their life.
Absolutely.
And that was not very long ago, and that's where I met Dean Harnham.
Yes, and that was first week or so of April.
So the interesting thing about that is, unbeknownst to everybody in that room at the time, is that you were not Dean Harnham at that time.
No.
Who were you?
I was Sarah Dina.
And how did Sarah Dina, tell me about the process of creating Sarah Dina.
Creating Sarah Dina hasn't been so much a process of creation as one of emergence. I just let her out. I found a key to the door that didn't exist in that little box. And about 3 years ago, and I opened the door and I walked a very long corridor towards a light at the end. And along the way, I found people like PFLAG and groups like PFLAG, the trans support group at MUN, the mature trans support group, Dr. Sarah, when she had the show here, Sarah McCauley, when she had the show here, I was just coming out about my sexuality. And her approach and her way of talking to the audience about sexuality and sexual variance and gender variance, I don't want to say gave me permission, but really it did give me permission to realize my sexuality and then later on to acknowledge and stop fighting my femininity and become who I am today.
And so that process has been ongoing for about 2 years now, you say?
Well, about 3 years, really. I started therapy about 3 years ago in earnest regarding gender. And about 2 years ago, I got with one of the sexologists down at Waterford, and they really started, we started parsing things out. And a year ago, about 14 months ago, actually, I started HRTS, hormone replacement therapy. That, in my case, involves two kinds of testosterone blockers and an estrogen patch. that I use every day. And blocking the testosterone and introducing the estrogen in March of 2017. By April 2017, my brain stopped fighting itself. I felt peace for the first time ever in my life.
An amazing process.
It's magic. It's beautiful magic.
So basically going to bed with a sense of peace and waking up the same way.
Yeah. Yeah. Having dreams that weren't all about other things. You know, the monsters under your bed that are really in your head.
It's a long journey because you're talking about, if we go back, something that you knew when you were six, but mm-hmm. you're currently 51 years old.
I am. So, I mean, that's 45 years. Just think about that. 45 years. That's almost like two consecutive life sentences in jail. And that's what I likened my existence to. In a small cell that I built. I built the inside, and then I built the outside. And I built the outside for the world to interact with so I can be part of society. Meantime, inside didn't grow very much. But then little things happen, and it grows a little bit. Then you grow a little bit more, and then the cell gets smaller. And eventually you have to get out of there because it's too small. So you push open the door, and you start walking. And you walk towards the light. And then about a year ago, like I said, when I started HRT, I started running towards the light. And in April 26th, 2018, was the first day I walked out of my house, still living in the little town of New Harbor, in a skirt and a blouse and a wig.
How did that feel?
Initially terrifying, but once that wore off and I realized you can do this, exhilarating is the only word. Pure exhilaration.
Now, you've been lucky and you've been smart because you, with regards to your workplace, you made sure you put let the people in work know early enough. Mm-hmm. So just tell me about how that process worked out, because I'm sure a lot of people will be interested in this as well.
Yeah. I think it was April 2017. One of our regional managers was at our office, someone I'd worked with previously. And I went to sat down to her office and I told her who I was. And cried a whole lot. estrogen makes you very emotional when you're not used to it. And she was totally open, totally accepting, totally, encouraging. And then she started working. And she spoke to her bosses and her coworkers and her counterparts in different parts of our department. And she got Respectful Workplace Newfoundland Labrador involved, and she checked in with the Human Rights Commission for Newfoundland Labrador and did all of her research and all of her, she did everything perfectly right. She moved mountains and bridged oceans to make this happen. And then she said, well, do we have a date? And that was in January this year. I said, April 30th. I said, that's the day I want to walk into work as me. So that was a Monday. So I took Thursday and Friday off before that and went, got all my IDs changed. MCP, social insurance number, driver's license, all the main ones. And gave myself a spa day. And Monday morning I got up and I got ready. And nerves overcame me. And I got sick twice. And I got ready again. And I went out through the door, and I drove to work. And then she took me around the office just the same as we would for a brand new employee, a brand new hire, and introduced me to everybody in the office. And I will say, for the most part, it went over swimmingly. It went over better than I could have hoped, because I fear it's natural when you're trans to fear telling new people who you are, especially in some place that's important, like your work, that you've been at for 20 years. I mean, I've worked with these people, like I said, for two decades, mm-hmm. literally. you know, we're all going to retire around the same time, a lot of us. you know, it went well. It went well. And out in the public, it's been great. I haven't had too many dirty looks, but that's their problem, not mine. I've had some really good looks from people, strangers, just down at the mall a few minutes ago, and a very nice-looking gentleman was checking me out, and I was letting him. But, you know, it was, and, you know, it's all affirming.
Now, you have a family. You have a mom and dad and mm-hmm. a son. Tell us about that.
Yeah. Well, a year ago when I started this process in earnest with the HRT, I wrote a letter to my mom and dad and explained, you know, just everything was in my heart. And I let them deal with it and digest it and process it. And when I came out fully, I gave them a couple of weeks to get used to the idea because they knew I was out because I changed my Facebook and all that stuff. And on mom's birthday, I went up and brought her a present and walked in. My dad didn't recognize me for the first second, right? Just for that second, he said, "I didn't quite know." He said, "I thought you were a woman from Hearts of Light," which was great. It shows me I did something right with makeup. And mom is doing well. She's adjusting. Right, this is a big shock for them. They are in their 70s, and I completely understand that. They're doing better than a lot of people would. A lot of my friends' families have gone, you know, absolutely bonkers and disowned them, and oh my God, it's been terrible for some people. Other people, it's been great.
You're still their child.
I'm still their child. Right? I'm still their third child, and you know, just that they thought they had two sons and a daughter, and they've got two daughters and two sons.
Their child who can't put a dish in the sink.
I was a chef, man. I had people doing that for me.
we've come a long way right today in the story of your life to bring mm-hmm. us to where we are today. Mm-hmm. I notice sometimes when I look at the story about the goings on, say in Alberta, places in Alberta, the incident at Springdale with the mm-hmm. the sidewalk, the yep. incident at Middle Arm, where there seems to be an underlying sense among parents that if they have the ability to protect their child from the perils of a life that's foreign to them, whether it would be lesbian, mm-hmm. gay, bisexual, mm-hmm. transgender. Yep. Can you explain to them if you think that's a true concept?
Well, the concept that you're protecting them from exposure to LGBTQ people, you can't. Unless you're going to box them up in the house and turn off the TV and turn off the internet and the telephone, you can't. They're going to go out and they're going to go to college, or they're going to go to university, or they're going to go to work. And there are going to be queer people there. There are going to be trans people there and gender variant people there and all shades of the rainbow. We're all there. We've been there forever. We've been there from the beginning of time. It's better for them to adjust while they're young, while their brains are still learning, that these people are okay. They're not weird. They're not sick. You can't catch the gay. You can't pray it away either. All right? You know?
I don't wait, write that, by the way.
Please do.
You can't catch the gay and pray it away. That's on my list right there.
Please do. All right, my gift.
Well, I'll give you a songwriting credit. How about that?
Perfect. like I said, you can't protect them. You're not actually, you're probably doing them more harm than good by isolating them from new ideas and new ideals, you know? It's, you know, God made us the way we are. Like, I'm a Christian, and I will always be a Christian. And God made me exactly the way I am. For what reason, I'm not really sure. He hasn't let me in on that one yet. But he's made me. And he made your kid, whether they're straight or gay or whatever, right, just the way they are. Right? And, you know, it's just, I'm not sure what the word is, but it's something, you know, if you don't know it at home, they know it at school. Their friends know it. Heck, the internet knows it. There are a lot of really safe places online where you can go that are very well moderated for younger people, where they can go and ask intelligent questions. And if someone gets creepy or someone gets out of line, they're either shut down or the one site that I'm thinking about, they're booted like that. It's that quick. Right? People are constantly watching. And it's a very, very safe place to go.
Sarah Hernum, I'm really glad when you came in and we got the chance to meet and have this conversation tonight.
Okay.
I hope the listeners really took something home. It's nice to see, instead of the letters LGBTQ, to actually see the human being who is shares one of those designations.
Actually, I have several of those designations.
Sarah, it's been a pleasure. I guess I'll see you at the next NL Poly.
More than likely.
Sarah Hernum is a resident of New Harbor. She emerged 1 month ago tomorrow.
Yes.
I'm going to say happy anniversary in advance.
Thank you.
Pat, we're going to go to the break. And when we come back, we are going to have a wonderful, wonderful night. Stay with me, will you? Don't go away.
VOCM's Nightline. Call now. 273-5211 or 1-888-590-VOCM. This is Nightline on VOCM.
You're listening to VOCM's Nightline. VOCM's Nightline is brought to you by Cowan's Optical. Cowan's Optical, where the focus is on you.
We're back. Well, you know what? That was, I don't know. Of all the radio I've done here, that might have been the nicest interview I've ever done. Sarah was open and honest, and it was great, a really great conversation. So if you'd like to, I know Twitter, I'm getting some responses on Twitter. I'm using Daryl Power NL and Jonathan's, or the at VOCM Nightline on Twitter. Pat is out getting a caller now, I believe, so we'll just wait for him to line that up. Are you, Pat? Are we good? So to give you a second, I'm gonna take a minute to breathe. I'm just going to do some breathing, okay? Yeah. I feel better. I actually walked her to the door and then, you know, bolted back into the building, so it took a little bit. I think, are we going to see, are we talking Signal Hill, Pat? Is that what's happening? And just, this week, the last few days, Signal Hill and the Signal Hill community, it's a great neighborhood, a neighborhood full of great people, and they were a little concerned with a new development in their area, and they were also a little concerned with the fact that sometimes developers can be in contact with the city for quite a long while before neighbors find out about it. We're going to peel back a couple of layers on that because one of the people spearheading this initiative and rightly so being vocal against it is Mona Rossiter, and she's on line one. Good evening, Mona.
Hi, Daryl. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for taking the time to fill us in on what's happening. For those who don't know, give us a little explanation.
Well, let's see where to begin. Well, I guess there's a zoning, a rezoning application that was put in to the city by Premier Executive Suites to rezone an area right on Signal Hill Road. It's called 22 St. Joseph's Lane, but it actually is right next to the St. Joseph's Convent, that section of land there, and they want to put in 14 rental units, which are part of their Premier Executive Suites offering, which is a hotel on Signal Hill. So we got notification as per the city process. You know, we get a couple, you get, I think, 2 weeks, you get a letter in the mail if you're within a certain distance of something happening in your neighborhood. So we all got the letter in the mail and, you know, took a look at what the city had posted online and came together as a as a neighborhood group and said, this is not appropriate zoning for this neighborhood. It shouldn't be rezoned, and this kind of hotel development is getting out of hand in that area, and we really need to mobilize and say, no more. You have to engage with us as a neighborhood first before you decide to change up the residential zoning and allow, you know, more hotel development and more apartment dwelling development. So that's what happened, and that's why we've come together as a group now to object to that, and we've been involved for the past couple of weeks now.
There was a couple of things that I found a little, sort of sleight of hand. One was the fact that it was the permit was looking for a short-term rental space.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, this is, I think, what's most alarming to us is that, you know, when you look at what they've asked the zoning, they've asked for it to be rezoned to an apartment medium density. And on the surface, it sort of looks like, okay, it's an apartment building. But we all know from living in the neighborhood, and if you just a simple Google search, will you call up hotels in Signal Hill or go to Air Canada when you're booking a flight? And one of the offerings is a hotel. Signal Hill Gate, the existing Premier Executive Suite, is a hotel operation. And they're asking for it to be rezoned to apartment medium density because it falls in as a rental. It's really masquerading as a rental, an apartment rental. It's really a commercial office hotel zoning that they're really seeking. But and there's a whole lot of other implications here. If they rezone to apartment medium density, while the development design now, you know, has two stories, they would be allowed to go to six stories under those development guidelines. So it's once you start digging a little deep, it's masquerading as an apartment complex when in fact it's really an extension of their hotel operation, and that's disturbing, you know.
The units as they exist, the hotel as they exist right now, I mean, it is very tasty, very well done. This new application, is it for like a brand new build and on extra land that's there?
Yes, it is. It's let me go back to your comment about it looks attractive and so on. Well, listen, it's not a design issue. We're not arguing about the design they have or even the design they've proposed. What we want to make clear, and we think that this is why we started the petition, this is why we raised some concerns about it, is that the design is really the secondary issue. It's a change from a residential use in that neighborhood to apartment, medium density, commercial hotel operation. And it's already had some pressure from Home Hotel and Premier Executive Suites that are there, which are really hotel operations. And you start letting more hotel type operations happen, and, you know, the floodgates are opened. So from a design perspective, this is not what the issue is. It's the zoning and the land use issue. And I might add too, which maybe some people don't know, is that the existing Premier Executive Suites got its approval under a non-conforming use under the residential zoning when it did open up, you know, several years ago. So it in itself is a non-conforming use, and that was allowed to slip through. So with that slipping through, now all of a sudden, a few years later, they're asking for another zoning change and something else will slip through. And then, you know, mark my words, several years down the road, there'll be another application to go either higher with the building or put in more commercial development. So the track record of this type of stuff happening and it's kind of a slippery slope is not good. So we feel we need to, okay, put the brakes on now, stop this. And we asked the city councillors not to support this and really go back to leaving it a residential area like it's zoned. And the other thing too, you know, there's so much I could say about this. The other thing is too is that, you know, under the local area plan for this area, and even the city's new Envision St. John's draft municipal plan, the whole idea was to keep this neighborhood, this historic neighborhood, a historic neighborhood, residential buildings, you know, row houses, multi-use type, you know, semi-detached duplexes, you know, then the character of the neighborhood intact. So even the city's own zoning regulations for this area don't allow it. It would have to be changed up, and a change to the municipal plan would have to go through. And so there are a lot of changes would have to happen to make this happen. And it's totally in contravention of the what the city says is trying to achieve in building neighborhoods.
Have you been in touch with any councillors?
Oh, yes, we have. Right. So we went to the public meeting that was on May 16th and Wednesday evening, and Deputy Mayor O'Leary was there, and Councillor Sandy Hickman was there, and Jamie Korab, and it was chaired by Councillor Stapleton. So they were all there and heard our arguments, and Maggie Burton, we've been in touch with Maggie Burton, and we've also our ward councillor, Hope Jameson, we've been involved and in touch with her too regarding our issue. So we will continue to lobby the councillors because we feel they need to know, or they need to dig deep into some of what is being proposed here. You know, the other thing we learned, and I found this really disturbing, I got to say, is when I did look at all the city's documents, city had been approached by the developer back in May 2017. They put forward an application and said they wanted to do this development in that area. That's back a year ago. And then the process that the city has is the developer then engages with the planners in the city, and they kind of work through all of that. And then it comes to a public meeting, which is like 10 months later. So for 10 months now, the developer has been working with the planners. We get a notice in the mail, and 2 weeks we have to mobilize before this public meeting happens. And then in the developer's letter, and I brought this up at the public meeting on behalf of our neighborhood association at the meeting, I read from the letter, and in the letter that the architects put into the city, and the city repeated in some of its information, it says that they met with local residents. Nobody from the developers met with local residents ever. You know, they might have spoken in a parking lot with a couple of people, but there was no meeting with the residents. You know, so that's misleading. It was put into the information to the city. The city repeated it. It's never happened. We brought it up at the meeting and said, you've never met with any of us because we're the neighborhood and nobody from your development organizations met with us. So that's not good enough. So if one thing is not right, well, what else is not right? It just reduces that credibility. Like if you've misled there, what else are you misleading us on? So it just doesn't feel good. It's not the right application for this for that neighborhood to do that kind of rezoning. And we want our councillors and the city to know that. So we're going to take all the necessary steps we can to make sure our voice is heard.
Is there going to be, now that you have brought this to the attention of the city, do you think there's something needs to change at City Council and at City Hall with regards to when to make residents in the neighborhood aware?
Oh, I am so glad you brought this up because, yes, the city's process is flawed. And I'll tell you because I was in Halifax this week and I took some time to find out more about the Halifax processes, you know. So, you know, there, if a zoning change comes, and this is Halifax, this is not like a world away from us. If a zoning change comes to a Halifax, you know, council, they have a way more robust process. There's an internal review like we do. There's a public information session. Then they make recommendations. Then it's published in the paper. Then the planning department takes those, you know, any feedback into account. Then there is actually a planning advisory committee, which is staffed by citizens. They hold a public hearing. Then that goes back to a community council. Like the process is so much more robust, and it engages citizens more. Now, it's not perfect. There's a lot of complaints about their processes too. But I'll tell you one thing that needs to happen. As soon as a development application comes to the city or any zoning related to a neighborhood should be brought in right at the very early stages to say, this is what's happening, and we should be involved. The city should be the ones engaging us to say, you know, help us shape your neighborhood, because we need to be involved in shaping it, not just reacting to proposals that come forward in the 11th hour. It seems to us like we think, well, you know, we're kind of almost the last hurdle that developers seem to feel they need to get over before the stamp is given. And it shouldn't be that way. And I know other neighborhoods are facing this very same thing. I know in Kenmount Terrace, you know, there are people in there that have been fighting for park space and rivers and playgrounds. And the whole process of engaging the citizen is really flawed. We're brought in way too late. We're always in a react, respond, confrontational situation. And we'd rather not be there. We would rather be involved, you know, early on to shape our neighborhoods, to explain what it is that's appropriate in our neighborhoods and work with the city and work with planners. That's our preferred way forward. But we're put in this situation now where we have to, you know, mobilize quickly, gather the facts, learn everything. And we don't have paid staff. You know, we're all volunteers. Right?
The other thing that strikes me as funny is that it was 2015, I think, the city had a heritage planner, like as a position of employment within the city, and I think that person went and moved somewhere else. And I think it's high time we look at putting good money in a good place to bring an expert on heritage planning and urban planning, someone who's worked in a larger city, someone who knows the pitfalls, because it seems like we're stumbling through the dark sometimes on a case-by-case basis.
Yeah, I feel that too. I think we need more investment in that part of staffing at City Hall. And I know there are good people down there and they try to do their best, but I think they're under-resourced. And I also think like our processes, our engagement on zoning and development issues are really outmoded. They're outdated and they're outmoded. And, you know, this kind of brought in at the 11th hour, or and even at the meeting that we were at, and the planner that was there representing the city said, well, this is the process that I have to follow, you know. Well, then the process is wrong. And the other thing is like, well, what other zoning should we apply under? Because the only zoning that applies is this. Well, then your zoning regulations need to be updated. And if it doesn't fit in under hotel and it doesn't fit in under apartment, then you need to look at what fits in under what as a city and update all of this information. Because the other thing too is, we brought this up at the meeting and we put it in our letter to the city, is that, you know, other jurisdictions are struggling with this very same thing of what we call creep, you know, hotel creep in areas that are residential, with the Airbnb and vacation apartments and short-term rentals. You know, they're sneaking into all kinds of neighborhoods, and cities are behind on regulating them, and even behind on taxation for these kinds of rental units. So that kind of stuff has to be looked at now. So we think the city needs to put the brakes on, not approve this development, and start looking at how they're going to deal with these kind of developments that are masquerading as one thing, but they're really another thing. You know, they're really hotel developments.
You know what? Thank you very much for taking the time on a Friday night to have this chat with me. And I think after having this conversation with you, that every neighborhood would probably be better off with a Mona Rossiter living in it.
Well, I'd be willing to work and help any neighborhood, but, you know, there's so many good neighbors out there trying to do things that I think we should all come together and share our ideas. And I just want to remind people that on the VOCM website, you have posted a story and interviewed some people in the neighborhood, and there's a link to the petition that we've got online. So we'd really like the listeners to VOCM to go to that story on your site and find that petition, and you can click the link and sign it electronically online. So that's really, I think, helpful to us, because we can, you know, Signal Hill neighborhood is not just our neighborhood. It's important to everybody, because lots of people come to Signal Hill and to the whole area and enjoy it. And I think lots of people don't want to see it just changed willy-nilly without some good thought put in.
Thanks for this, Mona. I really appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome, Daryl.
Bye-bye.
See you now. Okay, bye.
Great call. We're going to quickly go to the break. When we come back, you know what I'm talking about. We're talking to Regatta. We're talking with Chris Neary. He's on the line. Don't go away.
VOCM's Nightline. Call now, 273-5211 or 1-888-590-5211. VOCM. This is Nightline on VOCM.
Welcome back to the program. This first Wednesday of August, the 200th running of the St. John's, the Royal St. John's Regatta. President of the Regatta Association, Chris Neary, is on the line. Good evening, Chris.
Darryl, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for holding.
No problem.
So let's start. I know we're going to have a look at just how many women are taking are involved in the regatta, but let's just go back and tell us about why this 200th anniversary is so special.
Well, you know, I think you look at the history of the regatta, and really the history of St. John's have gone hand in hand. When the regatta sort of just started off, the St. John's was, you know, barely getting started, had you know, just very few residents, mostly people coming in for the fishery seasonally. And it's grown with the city and really become part of our culture and our heritage in the city. And I think it's something real special because it's been with us every day, every year, right on through. So I think, you know, more so than just a sporting event, it's a cultural and cultural event of very, very big significance.
I remember being a kid and being lucky enough to be, you know, toddling along behind Dad and being with the skippers on the other side of the boathouse, who used to be literally knew all the racers, all the races, and they used to have a big pool on who'd win each individual race. It was a big thing for those people. And there's also the great stories of you know, once upon a time, the men taking that afternoon nap in the Dominion parking lot when it was still grass. We've come a long way.
It's funny, you know. I've talked to a lot of people over the last few years, and it seems like every family has their own real regatta tradition or history that they love to talk about. And of course, you know, the thing that everyone says is when they come down to regatta, they see people they haven't seen since the previous regatta. So it holds a pretty special place amongst the people of the great St. John's area.
It's become a great way for people to socialize and get in shape, and you've had almost an embarrassment of riches with how many female crews are down on the pond. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's great to see. I mean, certainly started probably mid to late 90s, but we saw the numbers started to increase. And it's certainly plateaued probably the last 4 or 5 years at about 70% of all our participants in female. It's great to see. It's, you know, we're happy with it. Of course, you'd like to see a 50-50 and get those men involved. But the fact that there's so many women supporting us, the Regatta Committee, and, of course, more importantly, the event itself, we're really excited.
How many crews are registered this year?
We, in the past, we've accommodated our highest total registration was in the mid-90s. We hit about 130 teams. Last year, we hit triple digits for the first time at 100 teams. And, of course, we didn't really know what to expect this year, and it's sort of gone beyond our expectations. We cut registration off at about 126 teams because we wanted to make sure we could accommodate everyone. We opened a wait list, and we've gotten another 21 teams. So we're doing our best now to try to squeeze everyone in Regatta Day. We're going to go earlier, go right through lunch, and hopefully, fingers crossed, we're working through the schedule now, and we should be able to let all the teams know that if we can accommodate them.
Last year, there was going to be talk of actually turning it into a two-day event because tons of people are down at the pond on the evening before. What happened to that plan?
We, I mean, everyone wants to row a Regatta Day. That's, you know, that's the big day. That's the big event. That's when everyone's coming down. Regatta Eve certainly is becoming an event in itself for those who come down every year. It's a special thing. We've added a concert Tuesday evening and really expanded the vendors that are down there. But, our goal is to accommodate everyone Regatta Day. Right now, it seems like we're going to be able to do that. If push comes to shove, we get a larger influx of teams coming that haven't registered yet. It's certainly something we'll look at, but we're hoping that everyone can get to row the big day.
Now, with so many crews rowing, there's only so many coxswains to go around, and I've heard a little rumblings of the fact that there might actually be a shortage of coxswains. Is this something that you're concerned with, and what are you going to do to try to address it for future years?
I mean, it's a problem every year. You know, there's, you know, 100 teams and probably about 50 or 60 coxswains. So you do the math, and we really lean on our coxswains. They're all volunteers themselves. And, without them, the regatta wouldn't be here. So We've been putting off for the last few years a coxswain's clinic and course, teach new rowers and non-rowers alike to come down, learn how to do it, and you know, we walk them the whole way through and make sure they're comfortable and experienced, and then we obviously let them take a new crew. Of course, you know, we keep helping. We have a learn to row technical director that assists new teams to find coxswains, and we're doing everything we can. And you know, the volunteer support from the coxswains is huge, and we certainly appreciate all the work they do.
The one thing that might we can probably take heart in is the fact that with so many new female crews and such great interest, maybe what will end up happening is we're going to see some top-notch female coxswains emerge as well, because the ratio, although there's more women rowing, there's more men still at the coxswain position.
There is, but you know, I'd make a suggestion that we've got some fabulous female coxswains. In fact, we had a few years ago, Haley Ivany was the first female coxswain ever to steer a men's championship winning team. Mm-hmm. So that's fabulous. And you're right, I think that's only going to continue to grow, and we certainly encourage it and certainly promote that.
We need another couple dozen more Gert Reardigans.
Oh, do we ever. What a fabulous woman.
Yeah. Who was that? Because she must have been the first, I guess. But she was running a lot of crews.
She was the first female coxswain, no doubt about it. And obviously she's done a lot of firsts. And first to win a race, first to steer a men's team, bunch of firsts. And she certainly, and of course, you know, a very valuable regatta committee member herself. And she's certainly been recognized that. We've put her in the Hall of Fame.
A little bouquet tossed out to Gert Reardigan on a Friday night. That's not bad, is it?
Absolutely.
I'm dating myself. You know that, don't you?
No, not at all. You're just well-versed.
Chris, thanks for this. I appreciate it.
Appreciate it, Daryl. Thanks for the time.
No doubt. We'll be talking to you when we get close. I'm sure I constantly end up hosting the Tuesday night show before the regatta. Let's make a date for that right now, okay?
I think the last few years we've done that together, so I'll certainly be available. You let me know.
It's our annual chat. I reach out to you and like a Gerard Dorn, and we all have a grand yarn.
Absolutely.
Okay, then talk soon.
Thanks, Daryl.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Chris Neary with the Regatta Committee. That's taking us to the news. We got a little busy next hour planned. I was dragging my butt in the first hour with these long conversations, but there's still room to hear from you. Let's go to the news. Ben Murphy is reading the news. And for those of you who don't know it, I'm just going to say it right here, okay, right now. A fine-looking man, okay? I'm talking about, and I don't mean this, I'm not just blowing smoke here, people. He is a fine-looking man. Don't go away. Back in a flash.
VOCM's Nightline. Call now. 273-5211 or 1-888-590-VOCM. This is Nightline on VOCM.
We're back. Daryl Powers in the chair. Let's see if we can get through a half dozen, seven or eight in this hour. Let's go. Let's start with, this is a great call, and it is, I do enjoy talking about this. It is that time of year. We talk about garbage. We talk about how can reduce, reuse, and recycle. And one of the best way to do this is with your food products. Many people don't compost because they're a little afraid about how to actually go about it. Look no further. Tim Walsh is with the Munn Botanical Gardens, and he is going to help us through it. Good evening, Tim. How are you?
Oh, I'm good, Daryl. How are you tonight?
Now, you're a composting expert.
Well, yes, I suppose I am.
There's no fear for you.
Not at all. I dive in every year, all the time, 24/7, 365.
First thing I got to ask is, like, how often am I talking to people, and is it true, or is it like this, what's become sort of contemporary legend, that people are afraid to compost because they're concerned about rodents?
Well, that's definitely a concern with it. There's no doubt about it, and I'd be lying if I said that it wasn't. We teach composting all the time at the Botanical Garden. We had this great relationship with the Multi-Material Stewardship Board in the City of St. John's Waste Reduction. And they came to us a few years ago, and they knew that we had been doing it well, because we've been composting since the Botanical Garden started back in 1971. And so we developed this relationship where we would help them teach citizens of St. John's how to compost properly. And to say that you'll never have rats and rodents around your compost if you compost would be unfair. But there's definitely ways that you can do it in order to reduce the likelihood of that happening.
That's what I wanted to get right out of the way quick, so then to just to open people's minds to the possibilities of beginning it, because once they get that beautiful black earth and they get the opportunity to put that in the garden and see what it does to their plants, it's they'll get the satisfaction from what they're putting the work in the first place.
Absolutely, and I think the folks that do compost and end up with that successful result, which is not that difficult to attain, they can certainly realize, they really quickly realize the benefits of that, and they say, well, I'm going to make this happen no matter what I need to do here. So let's get the rodents out of the way. There's no doubt that that rodents are, well, by the very nature, they're scavengers. That's what they do. They look for food all the time. And I always say to the people who come to these sessions that if you believe that your compost is the reason why there's rats in your neighborhood, well, you're fooling yourself and you're doing an unfair justice to yourself. Because if you think about it, rats are just about everywhere. Rats and mice are. Yes, they're probably more popular in and around maybe rivers or industrial areas because of what they do. They scavenge for food. They're constantly looking for food. So they're going to be around areas where there's more of that around. So around maybe shopping malls with a lot of dumpsters and those types of things with food in them. So let's say that right away, that your composter is not the reason why there's rats in St. John's or in your neighborhood for that matter. They're pretty much all around everywhere. They're scavenging for food all the time. They're incredibly adaptable animals. They're on every continent on the planet. So for that reason, they're there anyways. But they are shy, and they prefer to hide, and they like sort of warm areas, and they like to come out at night, and they travel along fences because they don't like to be preyed upon by other animals. So there's things that we can do during our composting to ensure that that they're not going to set up in our compost.
Thanks for all that information. Now let's get to the composting itself. You guys are doing some free sort of backyard sessions. Tell me about when and where these are happening.
Yeah, we've been running them now for a while, and we'll run them throughout the year. There's one actually tomorrow at the Botanical Garden at 1 p.m. tomorrow, Saturday. We run them pretty much every week or 2 weeks. No particular, set schedule. There is a set schedule if you look on our website, but there's no sort of even space in between. So there's one on the 26th of May, there's another one on the 3rd of June, and there's another one on the 17th of June, and so on. So anybody who's interested in attending can certainly find those on our website, at the Mon Botanical Garden website, or certainly on our Facebook site. All those details are there. But they're about a one-hour session. Folks will come in, learn all about composting, learn how to take care of those rats, learn how to build proper composting, how to build your containers, what kind of containers to use. And you can even purchase them through the city at a reduced rate if you attend some of these classes.
That's probably the best way to start composting, by buying one of these little bins?
Yeah, sure thing. I mean, certainly the bins have been designed to make compost. There's no doubt that you can go and build your own. And, really, if you think about it, what are we doing? We're putting all this organic material together so it rots, really. So the material itself doesn't really care what kind of container it's in. As long as you're building your compost properly, it'll rot down. But, just to remove all those ifs and whats, at this point, if you're just starting out, it's probably advisable to purchase one of these black bins. They're already designed. They've got air spaces in there. They've got a lid. They've got a nice opening space. In fact, you can even buy a tumbler bin that the city provides, and that is an actual drum that's on legs, and with a door that you slide open, drop your food in, and then it spins around like a lottery ball almost, and it mixes up the material inside, and it really speeds up that process as well.
How big is that tumbler?
The tumbler is, I don't know the sort of the cubic in this cubic space inside, but it's about the size of the amount that you would fit in a very large wheelbarrow, to give you an idea.
Go ahead.
No, it's a closed bin, so there's a sliding door. In fact, it's separated into two chambers, so you can start putting in one side first, and then as that side fills up, one half of the drum, then you stop putting into that side and start putting into the other side while you allow that first amount to decompose.
Is sunlight essential?
Sunlight helps, of course. The material is inside the containers, but these particular containers are black plastic, and that's by design. because black will, when it does, when the sun does shine, it will absorb the heat from the sun and help to build up the heat inside. Because there's no doubt about it, when the compost is warm, it does break down faster.
Let's talk a little bit about what we put in and the ratios, because that gets tricky for some people too, which also prevents them from even starting.
Yeah, it surely can. So the idea about composting, your compost materials are broken down basically into two different sections. And we call them browns and greens. And greens are things like fresh grass clippings and fruit and vegetable scraps and plant trimmings and, you know, tea bags and all those types of things, that very kind of common household waste, that organic waste. And then the browns are more dry ingredients, and they're very absorbent and fibrous. And those are things like dried leaves and dried grass and shredded newspaper even, and even egg cartons and straw and sawdust and those types of things. And a really great compost pile is made when you put an even amount of those two ingredients in your compost, because the browns provides the air space, which helps the air kind of move in and helps the organisms, the macro and microorganisms, move through all those wet ingredients. And it breaks down nicely, then there's wonderful homogeneous material that we like to call compost.
What's a no-no? What shouldn't go in there?
Oh, well, there's certainly we like to keep out really problem weeds and things of that nature, like goutweed, which is certainly taken over parts of St. John's. We try and certainly keep those out. We really try and suggest that people not put in like dairy products and meat and fish bones and fats and oils and things like that. Mostly because you know, a lot of those ingredients will attract other animals to the compost pile. You know, some municipalities in other parts of the country do have municipal composting programs, and our city is certainly working towards that. And those programs, you're probably familiar with those in other cities. Folks have this bin in their house that's provided by the city, and you can put everything into that. You can put, you know, your meat and your fish and things of that nature in there. But now we're talking, that particular situation, we're talking about an industrial composter that's managed by a team of people. So they've got the system in place to break that down and to basically render that into a compost in a short time. In the home garden, that's not going to work as well. And we also do, as I said, want to avoid attracting other animals to the compost.
So tell me about, I get one of these beautiful bins, I start composting tomorrow. When can I anticipate having some great compost to put out in my flower bed?
It depends on your situation. So the composter, as you mentioned already, it should be in a sunny spot. So a nice sunny open area is good. If it's open again, it makes it less attractive to rats and mice, because they don't like to come out into the open. So if it's out in the sun, if we have that nice blend of browns and greens in there, we can definitely expect to have a usable compost within a year, year and a half. Our season is a bit shorter than other parts of the country, and so as a result of that, our compost does slow down and even stop in the dead of winter. So we have all this winter time where things are just pretty much frozen solid, and we can still add to it, but there's not a lot of decomposition happening at that point. When spring comes around, things start to rot down very quickly, and then, you know, the compost does kick in. So certainly we would expect a year, maybe even into the second year, before you would expect to harvest anything.
So tomorrow, 1 o'clock at the Botanical Gardens, is a great time to get fully caught up on how to do this, and you can start to process yourself.
Absolutely. And then if tomorrow's not your day, look on the website. Get some of those other dates, and certainly we'd accommodate you, and we'd love to see people coming out. We love talking compost. We love talking gardening. That's a great time of year for that.
Tim Walsh, thanks for this.
Thanks, Daryl. Great to talk with you.
Nice to talk to you, too. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
So that's it. People, don't be afraid of this. Please, don't be afraid of this. Now, next caller, Bridget Berry is a high school student at Waterford Valley High, and she is working with or volunteering with one of the many groups that high school students have now, and she's going to tell us a little bit about that and an event that's coming up. Bridget, how are you?
Good, Daryl. Thank you for having me on your show.
Happy Friday.
Yes, you too.
Tell me about the organization that you're a member of at Waterford Valley High.
Yeah, Yeah, so it's called the Mental Health and Wellness Committee, and I am one of the co-chairs. It's been around for a little bit, you know, a couple of years now, probably at since Waterford Valley started. This is my first year involved in it, and we just do, so it's like a student-run thing, but we do have teacher sponsors, one of whom is Glenda Jackson, our high school guidance counselor. So we kind of just do events around the school and within the community just to kind of educate people on mental health.
It's, of course, attitudes have changed a lot over the last few years, whereas it's not something that kids are embarrassed or ashamed to talk about anymore. It's many more kids are doing it and helping each other through the experience. Is that what you're finding?
Yes, yeah, definitely. It has definitely come a long way, but we do still have a bit of work to do on it, and that's why one of our main goals of the committee is to really just get rid of the stigma behind mental health. And like we said, specifically I find with anxiety and depression disorders, they are very talked about in the high schools now, and very normalized and destigmatized, and I've seen a lot of support surrounding those illnesses. But I guess what a lot of people don't know is that there are other illnesses as well, and you know, there is still stigma behind it, but it definitely has come a long way. And we don't just focus on things like disorders or illnesses, but we also just focus on like the well-being of our students and staff and the community. So yeah.
So how many students are volunteering in this committee?
Well, it's kind of a flexible committee. We're always very open to like new members and people who can only make it some weeks, but it's probably about 10 of us consistently, I would say.
That's nice. Now, the best part about this committee is the opportunity where peers can gather together and discuss. So are you holding an event? Can you tell us about what's coming up in the future here?
Yes, so this Monday, May 28th, at 7 p.m., we are holding a Jack Talk. So I'll just tell you a little bit about what that is. So it's a presentation led by an organization called Jack.org. And Jack.org is a national mental health awareness organization. And they basically share the message to our youth across the country that, you know, everyone has mental health and needs to care for it. And they inspire audiences, specifically youth in schools or universities or colleges, to continue talking about mental health and self-care through their Jack Talk presentations. They have a Newfoundland branch. They are actually founded in Toronto in 2010 by Eric Windler and Sandra Hannington, who unfortunately lost their son, Jack, to mental health issues. And it was, you know, he was a student at Queen's University. It was his first year. He was 18 years old. And, you know, like many youth in Canada right now, he didn't know how to reach out for help, and he struggled in silence. So Eric and Sandra created the Jack Project to specifically educate youth about mental health. And they do this through their Jack Talk presentations. I guess it's kind of like TED Talks, if you are familiar with that. Mm-hmm. But it's centered around mental health.
That's pretty exciting. How did you manage to, did you reach out to them yourselves?
One of the active members in our committee, Catherine Dibbin, she actually found out about them on Facebook, because they had a Facebook post saying that they were doing free Jack Talks for the month of May because it was Mental Health Week. So she kind of tagged me in this, and she said, you should check this out. And I was talking to them, because at first I thought maybe they were just based in Toronto, but no, they are actually coast to coast. So that's when we kind of became in contact with them. And I just asked them if this would be something they would be able to do for us, and they said definitely. And yeah, so we organized it for this Monday.
It's nice that it's not just for students. Parents can go too. It's a learning experience for all.
Yes, yeah. So it's primarily centered around youth, because that's usually what Jack.org does, is talk to youth, but definitely parents and teachers, because the thing is that we want to get as many youth around like the high schools that we can around the city. We really want to bring people together because it's an after school event, and like anybody's really welcome to just come and learn about mental health.
Are junior high students allowed as well?
They can. We usually say the age group is probably about 14, 15 to 18. So if I'd say, yeah, you can if you're probably like, you know, in grade 9, because there are, I guess, some more mature topics probably being discussed. But I think they can, and I think it'd be great, you know, because there are people who are going into high school from junior high. That's a big transition for them, and sometimes, you know, there's stress involved with that, and so, you know, it'll be good for them to know more about it and what resources to have and where to turn, you know?
Some people just go through high school and don't get involved with anything. How does it feel for you to actually become an integral member of a community and actually pull off this event on a Monday night? It must feel pretty good.
Yeah, it does feel pretty good. I knew I wanted to do something in my last year of high school just because I am very interested in mental health. I'm very interested in psychology in general. So when I kind of came to Waterford Valley, I said, like, I knew I wanted to get involved in mental health initiatives. And I knew I just wanted to make more of a difference in the school. And I really think being on this committee I've actually seen that. Like, I really have seen students in the high school and staff who really appreciate the committee. And so, yeah, it just makes me really happy that I was able to do it.
Well, congratulations to you for getting involved with your school and pulling off this wonderful event. It looks really good. I wouldn't doubt, but I might try and put the word in to someone from the VOCM team, and maybe the Jerry Lynn Mackey or someone might actually pop in and say hello and see what's going on down there.
Yes, that would be great. Anyone's welcome.
Thanks a lot, Bridget. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Daryl.
Talk again. Bye-bye.
Bye.
I love those calls where you're talking about the people who are going to be running this province in the future. Every time I speak to one of the youth in this province, I realize that we are going to be in good hands. Patrick, let's go to the break. When we come back, oh, I love Friday nights. It's Style Shift and Extraordinaire. I can't believe what I'm reading. We're going to talk roller derby. Don't go away.
VOCM's Nightline. Call now. 273-5211 or 1-888-590-VOCM. This is Nightline on VOCM.
You're listening to VOCM's Nightline. VOCM's Nightline is brought to you by Cowan's Optical. Cowan's Optical, where the focus is on you.
Welcome back to the program. We have Jane on the line. It's spring, and spring is about flowers and gardening and composting and roller derby. Let's go. Jane, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
You must be getting fired up for the new season.
You know, it's tomorrow night. We're really excited. We've got the track set up down at Jack Byrne Arena. We tested it out. Our skates are ready to go, and we're going to see what happens tomorrow night at the first season opener for 709 Roller Derby.
How long does it take to set up that track, and where did you? How did you get it?
How did we get it? Well, it's all homemade. Roller derby is a super amazing sport because it's very grassroots. The players run the league. The players set everything up. So basically, we're down there measuring out the track, putting down rope, taping it down with a lot of duct tape. They just get this huge box of duct tape ordered every year for these four bouts that we do in public. And we're down there on our hands and knees, taping it down and getting ready to go.
So you're telling me the secret ingredient to the roller derby rink is duct tape?
There's a lot of duct tape, yeah. But, you know, the secret ingredient is also spirit, heart, and really excited people that really love to put on a show for everybody and have a good time.
How many seasons is this now for the 709 Roller Derby League?
It's got going in about 2010.
That's a long while. I didn't know it was going that long.
I know, right? It is really exciting. It kind of came back as a modern sport in the, I guess, the mid-2000s. So it reached Newfoundland in 2009-2010, and yeah, we've been doing games for a while. And there's some people that have been involved with it from the very start. Some people are playing in their very first bout tomorrow night, so we're super excited.
Where did one get a pair of roller skates?
Where do you get it? You can't buy it. What we do is we skate on quad roller skates. So these aren't roller blades. They're like kind of the old-fashioned with the four wheels.
Head up here. I was used to skate up the Pine Line and thought I was the coolest man in the history of rock and roll.
Well, you totally were, because quad skates are awesome.
Yeah.
We order them online. There's a bunch of different stores in Canada, so we can support Canadian businesses doing that.
They're like black with yellow wheels. Styling. They were styling.
Could totally relive that. You could order another pair. We always
suddenly I get visions of bent over with a back spasm.
Well, you know, it's a pretty physical. I mean, it's not kind of a leisure activity. Everyone's gotten in a lot better shape since they've started practicing and doing a lot of our league practice. So definitely an athletic event. Lots of people have put a lot of time and effort into it.
I'm old school, so I remember well getting up on Saturday morning and watching roller derby on TV.
That's awesome.
You know, and, it was Skinny Minnie Miller was like a household name. Everyone knew who Skinny Minnie Miller was.
Sorry, did you know she recently passed away?
Did she?
Yeah, yeah. And a lot of people say, as soon as they tell somebody, I play roller derby, the first thing people say is Skinny Minnie Miller.
Yeah, a superstar.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because she was so tiny. And then you know, she could like go just her act, the acrobatics to go between someone's legs, because roller derby is about there's a room for everybody. Sometimes a size is important, but sometimes speed is just as important. So it's not just for people who are large and muscular.
So what we say is it's for all shapes and sizes. Anybody that's interested, we have a place for you in our league, because absolutely, you got some of the tiny people that are super fast. Some of the small people are really pointy with their hits because they got very sharp shoulders. And then we also need people that are going to be really solid and hard to get past because they're really strong skaters and really they make a solid wall, we say.
How many people on a team?
How many people? We can roster 15 people on the team, but the teams actually have a couple more people than that. So we select the 15 people that are going to play in each game. And teams have blockers, which are the people that form the walls and just try to get in the way. And the teams also have jammers. Jammer skaters are the ones that get the points every time we have, you could call it a round. We call it a jam, which is like a two-minute-long period where the two jammers are trying their best to get points by passing blockers, and the blockers are all trying their best to keep the other team's jammer behind them and get their jammer through so their jammer can get all the points.
So it's possible to get past a blocker once and then scoot around and score a second point before the 2 minutes is up?
That is absolutely the point. So jammers have to get past everybody first, and then on their second pass through the group of skaters, they get a point for each of the other team's blockers that they pass.
And how many people are on for each team during a round?
During each jam, there's four blockers and one jammer for each team.
Ah, four block. Yes, okay.
It's all coming back to you.
It's
now.
It's all coming back to me now. Yeah, that's right. I was thinking of something about a Moo Moo Cass. Was it Moo Moo Cass? There was another name that sort of disappeared. It's disappeared in this brain of mine. Go ahead.
It's super fun. It's so fun because we all come up with our own derby names. And sometimes you get a bit of that persona. Sometimes it really helps you kind of get in the mood to think about, you know, what your derby character is kind of like.
So what's yours?
I'm Betty Trooper.
Oh, nice. That's like it.
Inspired by my love of Archie comics as a kid and the fact that I had been watching Riverdale Season 1 while I did Fresh Meat, which is our training session.
I was always more of a Betty than a Veronica myself.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, gotta love the girl next door.
Right. she was just a little bit kinder. Don't you think?
Yeah.
So what's one of your some of the favorite names now that people are sporting?
What are some of our players? Let's see. We've got Slamuel Jackson on the Vixens. And on the other team, the Never Sweets, we have, what's a funny one? We have Salty Demise, which is kind of Sea Captain inspired. Also on the Never Sweets, we have Octopushy. And on the Vixens, we have BB Hate.
Love it. So tell us again, when is it underway and When can people see it?
Okay, our first bout, our season opener, is tomorrow night, 7 p.m. at the Jack Byrne Arena in Torbay. The doors are going to be opening at 6. Tickets are available online tonight until midnight at 709rollerderby.com. And you can also pay at the door to get in. It's $10 online tonight and then $15 at the door tomorrow night.
Very reasonable.
Yeah, absolutely. Also, kids under 12 get in free. So we are promoting it, that fact, because it's going to be a fun night out for everybody.
And you need new derbyers. So you must get those 12-year-old kids to have a look and see what it's all about.
You know what? The 12-year-olds can join the 709 Junior Derby League because that is also on the go, and that's something that's just a year old now.
And so how? What's the age group for that?
That's ages 8 to 18, and boys and girls are welcome to join. And they're doing the quad skates, and they've got tiny gear, and they are the most fearless people you have ever seen. Or doesn't bother them. They just bounce back up off it.
I think I spoke to, I've had a conversation with about this roller derby last year. Love the idea. It sounds like a lot of fun for a lot of people. Thanks for this, Jane. I hope you have a great crowd tomorrow night.
Oh, I hope we do too. Thanks so much for the call.
No sweat. Take care. Bye-bye.
All right, bye.
That's Jane. She's with the 709 Roller Derby League. We're going to go now to Ashley Wakeham. Oh, yes. I read a tweet from John Rich today to say, I must be pro-B because I'm anti-mowing. And I believe this is the story he's referring to. Ashley is on the line. Ashley, how are you?
Hey, Daryl. How are you doing?
There must be some lot of men in Bay Bulls happy with you.
Oh, they're delighted with those mowers in the garage.
Now, why on earth would someone leave their mower in the garage?
Well, I'm sure your listeners are aware, you know, the decline in the bee population is, it's really scary right now. So we're just trying to do our part and let everyone know, just leave those mowers alone. Leave the dandelions out.
Whose idea was for this campaign? Is this the first year for it?
Yeah, it's the first year. It's been, you know, it's been circulating globally for a while. We have a counselor, Joan Luby. She actually brought it to the office attention that maybe we should send out a little general tweet to the residents. We didn't expect it to explode like this. But we're just letting everyone know that it's, you know, we're actually pretty lucky here in Newfoundland, to be honest. We have a good colony going here. Our bees haven't been affected by any disease. We're actually, I think, one of about three places globally that haven't been affected the way that other places have. So we thought it'd be a good opportunity to let everyone know to just keep those bees healthy.
Just because we have a healthy bee population doesn't mean that we can't work to make sure that it stays healthy.
No, absolutely not. Yeah, they need all the help they can get right now. You know, they're dying off in alarming rates.
Well, what about here in Newfoundland?
Here in Newfoundland, like I said, we haven't been affected. So there's been no bee disease and there's been no mites associated with any colony collapse here on the island.
So I remember the weed season, we're in the throes of it now. You can just really see them appearing on all the lawns. And then I think it seems like there's another wave towards the August or something like that. Is that the way they really run?
Yeah, that's the way it would run.
So what you're suggesting is to let these weeds, do people don't necessarily have to wait until they go to seed, right? But at least...
Yeah, well, it'll be most important this time of year because after a long winter, you know, the bees are pretty hungry. They're looking for their first bit of food, and that's going to be their first line of defense to a healthy population is to get that first feed. So we're just letting people know, leave those dandelions alone for another couple of weeks and let the bees have a good feast.
I remember seeing bees all the time, but you know what? It's almost a treat to see one now.
Yes, that's true. They're hard to come by now.
So I can just imagine the wonderful, like, you've basically taken a Saturday, an hour and of a Saturday family, instead of having to mow the lawn, they can say, no, I'm trying to protect the environment.
That's right.
It's put a great, it really did take off this week. I saw it and loved it from the first idea. So glad I've had a chance to talk to you about it.
Thank you so much, Daryl.
Maybe some other municipalities can probably really jump on board and do this. It's really the right thing to be doing right now.
It really is. Yeah, I hope they do.
Great stuff, Ashley. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Bye. Bye. Gone to the break. Almost on time. My God, Pat. Going to break on time. I think we've got three or four callers left. Let's see if we can squeeze them in. Don't go away.
VOCM's Nightline. Call now, 273-5211 or 1-888-590-VOCM. This is Nightline on VOCM.
Welcome back to the program. There is definitely, Patrick is struggling away in there to some callers that were really ready to go all night. They don't seem to be ready to go anymore. So there's some time for you to get in now and have a little chat with us while you can. Get in there. But in the meantime, sure, we can always talk about lots, can't we? I can talk about the last two crazy weeks. I came in here last Thursday morning. I did Friday morning, Friday night for Jonathan. A full string of open lines, and then sitting in for Jonathan this evening. And I got to tell you, it is an awful lot of fun to sit in this chair. It's enough. It's been an education. The amount I learned in the last week about the intricacies of the salmon debate, what I learned about surf clams, what I learned about blue parking zones, what I learned about the issues with regards to development in Kitty Vitty, and what's going on in Whitburn with the compost facility there, what's going on with Grieg and the environmental impact study. It's totally gets you right on top of what is happening in the province, and I absolutely love it. This morning was an interesting day when you're sort of sitting there, you do a preamble, and you find out at 9:40 that at 10 o'clock you're going to be talking to the fisheries minister. And I say, boy, I wish I had a few extra hours to prep for that. But thank God the newsroom is a great help too, where they're working on that from the minute they heard. Now, we are going to go to Old Faithful. Old Faithful, you can't beat him. You can't beat him. I owes him a karaoke song. George Murphy's on the line. How are you, George?
Not bad. What are you at?
We are just... Picture, George... I tell you what, we are sort of underwater in a river with a recyclable paper straw sticking out of the water. You're just getting a breath here.
Yeah.
George, listen... a caller called in a little while ago this week, and they were wondering what is up with the fact that every gas station, in particularly in smaller rural communities and cities outside St. John's, doesn't have a Costco. They're all priced to the 1/10 of a cent, exactly the same price. Why is that?
Yeah, it's a good question, because you know they're making a healthy margin, that there is no doubt. And even after today's trading, which is why I was calling, I guess, even now, with prices pointing down about a penny and a half from what they have been, they're making another penny and a half right on top of it now. So there's no reason why that they can't drop prices. In some particular places now, the province, I can understand why they wouldn't drop prices. You get areas where you have, well, say, for example, very low volumes of gas sales, for example, a place like Grey River or whatever with a low population and still with having to try to carry an inventory of gasoline. I can see the reason why they wouldn't. But other centers, for example, like Corner Brook, Gander, Grand Falls, where you have a heavy turnaround of inventory, there's no reason why they wouldn't be competing against each other. So it begs the question, and certainly under the Public Utilities Board rules, they set a regulated maximum, and they make it a point to tell everybody too at the same time, this does not mean that you can't sell at a low price. You know, this is a line in the sand that you don't cross, so therefore don't cross it, or else you'll be subject to fines and all that sort of stuff. But there's no reason why they can't sell for lower. And, you know, it's a good question. But when you get a big player that happens to go into the market, for example, like Costco, and I encourage people to use gas stations in the Northeast, supposing you do have to travel, to send that message to companies out there that, you know, in some particular cases, you're looking at a 10 or 12 cent disparity in prices. You know, gear your purchases around traveling to the northeast end of town to do your business so that you can go ahead and avail yourself of that cheaper price, too, at the same time. And I do it myself. even though I live out in Seal Cove, but I do business in town, of course. I work in town, so I make sure that I'm going to make purchases in the northeast end of town, and I try to make that little impact myself. So, you know, you have to be wise when you're shopping, too, at the same time, and every chance you get to avail of it. But, you know, a lot of stations, you know, like I said, in St. John's, as a result of Costco moving into the market, are sometimes, you know, 4 and 5 cents well below that regulator maximum. Matter of fact, Costco has had that much of an effect here in the northeast Avalon that, in fact, well, right now the prices that you see are pretty much the prices in Toronto, with the exception of the 4.5 cents provincial taxes still left over from budget 2016. So, you know, we're on an equal footing with everybody else in the country when it comes to the prices that we're seeing, but still, no excuse whenever you see a downtrend in the markets why some of these gas stations don't drop the price too in the meantime, because they're still going to be making a healthy margin as a result of that. Right?
Have you ever gotten an answer from any of the gas stations as to why it's done? You know,
they just get their commands from places like Montreal, for example, when it comes to Ultramar, or New Brunswick, when it comes to the Irvings, and you know, it is what it is, I guess. You know, they do whatever they are told to do, and that's all there is to it. So
I didn't know that.
Yeah. It's just like dropping a rock in a pond in some places, particularly on the mainland. Even before regulation was here in the province, you could pretty much time your gasoline increases to exactly what was happening in Montreal whenever they picked up the phone and started calling their dealerships to reset prices and everything. And believe it or not, their timing actually got me to get involved in this sort of thing back in 1996, because at that particular time I passed by a particular gas station and the phone call came in. I looked at the price when I was going down the road, and it was 66.9. My God, that seems so long ago now.
Yep.
When I came back up the road, it was 68.9. The phone call had just come in within a 2 or 3 minute time span to adjust prices upwards. They wouldn't give me an answer as to the reason why. Told me that it was none of my business, and I made it a point to call them back that once I found out, everybody else was going to find out, and I've been doing it ever since. That was 21 years ago.
You made it your business for the last 21 years. That's pretty awesome.
It is, yeah. But anyway, listen, I wanted to tell everybody today that you know, I think that we have hit the summer peak in pricing outside of hurricane season. I'm on you, barring any other exceptionalities out there. We've got an awful lot of exceptional news out there that happened today, and that's one of the reasons why we've seen crude oil trading about $2.50 a barrel lower. And that has affected spot pricing. So now we're into a downwards trend right now so far the week. And we still got a couple of business good days to go yet. So, you know, my fingers are crossed on this one. It's not a big drop, but so far showing about a penny and a half down so far. So, you know, it's nothing big, but still at the same time as having said that, it's still a downwards trend that we're picking up on now as of, I think last week we were more or less calling the shot on U.S. Memorial Day weekend, and here it is. And this is supposed to be the peak of the year. Traders are into their 45-day buying cycle now, so they're pretty much into the July contracts and everything already now. And they're probably looking at, well, what kind of demand is there going to be towards the end of the summer? And at the same time, is that inventory data on Wednesday is telling us that there was a slight build in gasoline inventory. So there's a whole lot of things happening out there that consumers need to know about and get used to, I guess, pretty much every year. That once you see inventory building whenever prices are high, conservation is key to all this. Consumers get really peed off with the price, and you know it. That, in fact, that they've been butting heads on the issue now, of course, for the last couple of weeks. We've been watching and listening to all this, and at the same time watching for the reaction on the markets. And we got that reaction from the markets on Wednesday with the inventory data today, on Wednesday, and then we're getting the same reaction now from OPEC. And OPEC is actually, there's a couple of stories out there now in the news. OPEC and Russia are going to be boosting production from its production cuts that they instituted in 2015. They cut back then 1.8 million barrels off the market to every day to help absorb the glut of oil that's out there. They've now come out and said that they're going to be adding 1 million barrels a day back in there. So that's a pretty heavy number, and the markets, of course, reacted pretty heavily to that. Starting to see the retreat in crude oil prices and the refined prices.
What's going on with Iranian oil? Because I know it was on stream. Is it still flowing? And or the recent political upheaval between like the US and Iran, is that having any effect on what they're able to produce and sell?
Well, yeah, it's there. It's still in the news, of course, and we're keeping an eye to that one. And of course, the US are getting ready now to place sanctions on Iranian oil, and Iranian oil going into the States right now, about a half million barrels in the run of a day. The Iranians are actually going to the European Union now and hoping that the European Union, who are supporters of the Iran nuclear deal, by the way, they did not agree with Trump and the U.S. backing out of the Iran nuclear deal. The International Atomic Energy Agency has said that the Iranians are pretty much compliant with all the conditions that have been set on them. And, of course, the Iranians going to the European Union now hoping that the European Union are going to be buying up some of this extra 500,000 barrels, and I believe that they will, to help support Iran and help maintain, I guess, Iran's oil revenue too at the same time. So, you know, it's still going to be interesting to watch, of course, the whole tilt between the U.S. and Iran. If something is indeed going to happen, that condition is still out there in the market. That fear is still out there, I guess, of a potential shutdown of everything that's out there, but still, it's lessened that much so because of what the Iranians are planning to do. So they've got some sort of a plan in place to keep moving their oil. The U.S. is looking at exporting, too, at the same time. So we might even see another price war over oil prices yet, and we might end up seeing another precipitous drop if they really want to get picky with it. But all that is probably some ways down the road, but we're watching it all. Yeah.
It's another classic example of biting your nose to spite your face by actually coming out hard against Iran. They're going to put themselves in a little bit of a short-term difficulty where you look, a half million barrels a day is nothing to sneeze at.
No, it's not. And, you're looking at offshore Newfoundland and Labrador producing, what, about 300,000?
Mm-hmm.
Drop in the bucket, you know, when it comes to worldwide production, about 98 million barrels in the run of a day. You know, we're more or less just a pimple, proverbially, out there when it comes to producing oil. And hopefully in the next couple of years, we'll certainly see a lot more hauled out of the ground. And, either way, it's still a play out there. And like I said, we've got other conditions out there that are affecting, the oil markets, Venezuela. I can't even describe what's happening down in Venezuela because their production is after dropping off now by about 600,000 or 700,000 barrels in the run of a day as well, with all the turmoil and everything down there political-wise. So things are falling apart down there. Venezuela, of course, one of the major exporters, is part of OPEC as well. So even OPEC is looking at the drop-off in Venezuelan production, too, and adding more into the quote-unquote oil grid and hoping to keep that supply of oil going for everybody and lessen the economic concern the consumers have had over prices the last couple of weeks. So
pretty amazing when you think about, reading articles about everything going, that the new green economy and electric cars, and we're quietly making 100 million barrels of oil a day.
Yeah, it's quite a lot of oil. The other point that I wanted to bring up too, Daryl, watching the Canadian dollar when all this has been happening, we have been watching oil prices climb, and this is the first time, I think, ever in my memory in tracking oil prices that I have seen the price of oil climb, but the price of the Canadian dollar at the same time remain relatively steady, if not lose ground against the U.S., and of course a good thing to be watching out for, of course, today, even watching the market trading today, the Canadian dollar lost about 0.8, 0.9 cents against the U.S. dollar in trading, too, and at the same time, that affects consumers because, of course, I use the Canadian dollar noon rate to figure out the difference in prices from one day to another, too, at the same time, and take that market figure and crack it. And like I said, every time I see the Canadian dollar losing ground against the U.S., it costs the consumer out there in this particular case probably about 0.75 cents. That drop, instead of 1.5 that is projected to be now for next week, but still a couple of business days ago, that should be up over 2 cents somewhere with that loss of that 0.8 cents. So it's a pretty important factor in all this, and is one of the reasons why I had to keep watching that Canadian dollar too at the same time. And consumers need to be aware of it, that it might be good on a trade perspective when it comes to selling fish or whatever to various markets that the Canadian dollar is low. But it's bad, too, at the same time for anything that's coming into the province, too, at the same time from outside the country, particularly with the stuff that's being shipped in and everything with the high prices the way they are right now. We're at risk from everything from the higher price for carrots coming in to even such things as fuel surcharges and everything, too. So, we're we're subject to everything here, and it's all the more reason, and I guess in this particular case, you had to pat the government on the back for its agricultural initiatives too at the same time. That should be part of the green programming and part of the conversation when it comes to the new taxes, the carbon taxes and everything like that are coming in. So hopefully that's going to be a big conversation in the next couple of weeks too at the same time. Should be a concern for everybody.
George, my marathon, I'm at the finish line of this crazy VOCM marathon I've been on since last Thursday, and you're the last person to talk to. This is awesome.
I'll leave you with one last thought, then. Everybody go get your candles, because when Daryl Power goes off here, everything goes down with it. I think even Nalcor is on notice with you.
It was funny on Monday in VOCM when the lights went out, right? And That was I stood in the newsroom and said to all of them, the power is out, and walked out the door.
The power's out, walk out the door, yeah. And I heard Bugs Bunny saying that the lights went out all over the world.
You have a good weekend, George. Thanks for this.
I will talk to you again, buddy.
Always a pleasure. Bye-bye.
See you now. Bye-bye.
George Murphy, is there any better how he pulls it all together? That's it, folks. On behalf of myself, Daryl Power, Patrick Myler over the other side, it's been a fun night. It's been a great night. Hope you enjoyed it. Hope you enjoy the rest of your weekend. There's nothing to do but take off Baz's slippers and throw them in under the table. Push back Ron Pumphrey's chair, broken, no leg rest. Take off George McLaren's jacket and hang it over in the corner next to the bingo machine and Patty Daly's swear jar, which just can't wait to be filled next Monday when Patty comes back in. Pat Mike Critch's cigarettes. Mark Critch's water cigarettes. Three stale smokes on the table as an homage to the man, the legend. Pick up Randy Sims's I Love Mount Pearl mug. Yes, what a cup of tea I get out of that mug. Could it be the 2,000 perforations in the Tetley tea bag? I don't know. There's nothing to do but clean up the mug, put it in the sink, take the mop and clean up. Time for me to get out of here. By the way, I know a lot of people have been asking since the news. Yes, Ben Murphy is single, folks. Breaking. Ben Murphy, single. 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 He's accepting your calls now, 726-5590. Had a blast. I'll talk again. Until then, God guard thee, Newfoundland.